There's never a dull moment in birding. I like to think of it as a multi-sensory kind of experience. And when you walk the Malm Trail or the Monte Vista Refuge or Home Lake, I mean, you're using all your senses out there, short of eating and tasting. You're using all your other senses to experience the outdoors, the wind on your face, the beautiful bird calls that reach your ears, the eyes, the fragrance of the wildflowers as you hike and do your birding. So just it's constantly evolving, constantly changing, and you just turn the page and you're on to the next chapter.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for tuning in to the Outdoor Citizen Podcast. We're back in our Southside studio to bring you another episode. We've been on an extended break, spending some much-needed time in the great outdoors, hiking, biking, fishing, a variety of things. Today, our guest is John Rowinski, and he's going to be talking about birds and bird watching in the San Luis Valley. Welcome, John, and thanks for joining us here on the Outdoor Citizen.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So just a little bit of an introduction about John. John's been in the Valley for a long time. His career, he's retired now from his job as a soil scientist for the United States Forest Service in Wyoming and Colorado. He is a birding expert. He's an author. In fact, we've got a copy of his book here, Birding Hotspots of South Central Colorado. If you know John and you are Facebook friends with him, you have seen some of his really spectacular photographs, not just from here in the San Luis Valley, but from all of his travels as well. And finally, you may know him also as a drummer for the band Blue Sky. Talk about a Renaissance man. John Rowinski is the epitome of that. So thanks, John, and we really appreciate your being here.
Thank you, Marty. You're too kind. Thank you.
No, not at all. So let's start with just a little bit about what you're doing right now, and we'll go from there.
Okay. As you may know, I've been in the Valley for a little over 40 years, and during that time, back in 1982, I began a project of recording people's observations of birds. It had a very primitive start as a Word document. This was before spreadsheets and data tables and all that fancy stuff that we have today. But it began its life as a Word document, and I started recording people's observations. They would call, they would email, and I would enter that data into this Word document. Multiply that times 40 years, and suddenly it's grown to over 2,200 observations, and it's still sitting in a Word document. I haven't backloaded it into any other database, and, you know, I'm a septuagenarian now, and time is of the essence, I feel. So I'm kind of motivated to get the 40 years of bird data published, and I'm in the process of writing a memoir to do that. So it's going to take all those observations, at least put them into print and print a few copies off for local libraries to have, and it'll be a good future reference. It kind of fills the gap. Today we have a thing called eBird, which is a global database. People can see a bird and instantaneously enter data on their smartphones. So it's prior to the eBird global database, and it's in a Word document, and I'm looking forward to getting it published and done, and give people credit for the citizen science that they did over the years. I mean, there's a lot of enthusiastic people, and there's a lot of good information in there, and I'd like to make sure they get credited for those things.
Great. I'd love to get a copy of that book as soon as it's ready. Just let me know.
Yeah, it'll be a while yet.
So how did you get started birding? It must have been before you got here in the Valley.
Yes, it was. And two things happened. Two people influenced my life in birds. First one was my dad, and we lived in central Massachusetts, and he was a small game hunter. And so I trailed along through the woods at the age of 12 years old, and Dad would chase grouse and pheasants and woodcock and things like that, and he'd occasionally get something. So I thought that was really fantastic. Got me out to see birds in their natural environment, and then eventually examine them up close if he got one. So that was more of the consumptive side of birding and bird fascination. The other one was Mr. LeClaire, my sixth grade teacher. And Mr. LeClaire, I think, was a visionary in his own right. He was in the habit of taking kids to the local wildlife refuge as part of science class. And so here we were, a bunch of sixth graders going out to Wachusett Meadow Wildlife Sanctuary in central Massachusetts. And we're observing barn swallows and eastern kingbirds and things like that. And just kind of, it was kind of an epiphany moment for me. And birders have those epiphany moments where something really strikes them. And they go, this is really cool. Okay, so my epiphany moment was as we walked through the trees, a nesting goshawk, an angry female goshawk, came ripping through the oak trees and just flew right above our heads, doing 60 miles an hour and negotiating the dense thicket of oak trees. And it truly was a remarkable thing. So those kind of things were the triggers that got me started in birding, I think.
Wow, that sounds pretty remarkable. You know, I've had red-winged blackbirds dive bomb me when I'm riding too close to what they perceive as their territory, but never something like you're talking about.
Yeah, it was. So I had an interest in birds, but I also had a lot of interest in science, in forestry and soil science. And so that ended up being my pursuit in my career. And sometimes the biologist would say, well, why didn't you take up wildlife biology? And I said, because I wanted to keep birding fun, not a job.
Oh.
You know, and too often I saw my associates, the fellow wildlife biologists, get entangled in a lot of serious report writing. But I wanted to keep the birding side of things fun. And I also found soil and forestry work very fascinating as well.
Good. If someone were to take a walk on one of the Alamosa trails, Malm Trail, Riparian Park, the Oxbow, what kind of birds would they be most likely to see?
The amazing thing about birds is that there's seasonality to it, and there's always something new with each change in the month or each change in the season. There's something new to see. So we are in what I call kind of the summer doldrums. We have birds on territory that are breeding. They're not singing as much. The spring choruses that we had, where everything was happening just like a symphony out there, is somewhat subdued now because the birds are busy feeding young. They don't have time to sing, and so you have to use your eyes and try to catch them as they go between feeding areas and the nesting areas. So we're in a little bit of a lull, but every month, just stick around another few weeks, and we're going to get into fall migration. Believe it or not, August will bring fall migrants into our area. So it's a constantly changing thing, and there's never a dull moment in birding. I like to think of it as a multi-sensory kind of experience, and when you walk the Malm Trail or the Monte Vista Refuge or Home Lake, I mean, you're using all your senses out there, short of eating and tasting. You're using all your other senses to experience the outdoors, the wind on your face, the beautiful bird calls that reach your ears, the eyes, the fragrance of the wildflowers as you hike and do your birding. So just it's constantly evolving, constantly changing, and you just turn the page and you're on to the next chapter.
So what... can you cite just a few examples of birds that we're going to see right now during the summer doldrums?
Okay. The breeding birds that you might see at the Malm Trail are going to be the endangered southwestern willow flycatcher. And you'll be able to see this small 5.5-inch flycatcher, often recognized by its call notes, which is Fitzbew, Fitzbew. If you hear that, this flycatcher is the only one that does the Fitzbew. So that's going to help you identify it when you see this small bird in the willows along the Malm Trail. The other bird you're going to see is a small yellow bird flitting in the tops of the cottonwood trees, and it's going to be the yellow warbler. And it has a song, and it'll still be singing it. It's something like, sweet, sweet, sing so sweet. It has a couple introductory notes and then a nice little warble toward the end. So you're going to see that down there. You might see western kingbirds. These are very aggressive kind of birds. They're going to defend their territory. They're going to chase ravens, hawks away, be very defensive of their territories. And it is like a bit of a play in progress when you go out there. There's different acts, different actors and actresses all having different parts in this play of life. So really, really fascinating to see.
Yeah, we see western kingbirds frequently out at the riparian park also.
Yeah, no doubt. They're a very common bird, very used to people, and they'd like to nest around residences, rural residences. So
what are some of the most uncommon birds that you've seen here along the trails in Alamosa and Mata Vista?
Okay, I'm glad you asked that. I was thinking about that on the drive over, if there was anything that really stood out as very, very, very unusual. And it has to be a fall trip that I led a few years back. Can't remember exactly the year, but it was a fall birding trip for about 12 Valley residents. We birded all the hot spots here. We ended up going up Cat Creek area and looking for mountain birds. And on the drive back, we were all tired, exhausted. Our friend Lisa Clemens saw something dead on the side of the road. She said, oh, there's a dead bird. And I continued driving. She says, well, aren't you going to go look at it? I said, of course. You know, Lisa gets right to the point. And so I backed up, and the procession of cars backed up. We picked up this dead bird, and we started looking at it. And we couldn't really make heads or tails out of it. It had kind of webbed feet, had long wings like a seagull. It had a seagull-like bill. And it turned out that we had found a long-tailed jaeger, which is normally an Arctic bird, a bird that breeds up in the Arctic North. And here in the San Luis Valley, it had come through as a migrant, and somehow it got hit by a vehicle on that road. So we collected the bird, brought it back. It's in the Denver Museum now, and it is the first record of long-tailed jaeger in the San Luis Valley. So you think of that, and it just blows my mind that this bird, normally of the Arctic, and a great traveler, is going to go down to the South American oceans, should be found in our valley, and it was a remarkable find. There was some questions about its identity. I had to submit a rare bird report, put my reputation on the line a little bit every time you do that, and then that report has to go to a committee in Denver of seven individuals, very expert birders, that have to weigh it and look at it and decide if you made the right call, and they did approve it 7-0. So I felt very good that they upheld the decision. So and then to follow that up, it went to the museum, and they did some DNA testing on it, and it also confirmed it as a long-tailed jaeger. So stuff like that happens. I always say, never say never, because things can happen in birding that you wouldn't think could happen, and yet it will.
Yeah, a storm can blow the birds off course from their usual path of migration and end up here.
Yeah, it's happened before. in near Boulder one year, a magnificent frigate bird showed up. This is a bird that should be on South Florida flying over the oceans, and yet it was found near Boulder. And, you know, never say never. It can happen.
Do you have a particular bird that stops you dead in your tracks when you see it? Common or uncommon? Something you just say, wow, I just love to see that bird.
Yeah, I think it's probably the Western Tanager.
Oh, yeah, they're beautiful.
It's the male. You know, the male is just so striking with that fire engine, orange, reddish head, a yellow body, the stark black, dark wings. It's one that will just make me pull up and always get the binoculars on it and appreciate it for what it is. You know, in North America, we don't have a whole lot of tanagers. You go to Central America, South America, the tanagers are endless. It is just an explosion, a rainbow of colors. So the ones that we have are like summer tanager, scarlet tanager, hepatic tanager, and then, of course, Western tanager. And they're just brilliant in their colors. And that's one of those, a delicacy for the eye.
Indeed. Yeah. Yep. Indeed. Well, since you mentioned binoculars, let's talk about what equipment is best for someone who's starting out, and then you can migrate or you can morph into upgrading the equipment for once you're a more experienced birder.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I've always said, get the best binoculars you can afford. But that, you got to temper that with beginning birders and people that perhaps can't afford, you know, $3,000 Swarovskis have to look at something else. A good set of binoculars, and I bought these for my daughters before we went to Costa Rica. You can get Nikons and you can get Zeiss's in the $400 to $500 range, which is kind of affordable, that are really excellent and will last you a long time. They're generally water resistant and have really good optics. I would emphasize getting a large field of view. Okay, you don't want something so narrow that you can't find the bird. You could probably get decent binoculars even for the entry level from $100 to $200 range. One other thing I should mention is that the Arkansas Valley Audubon Society collects binoculars, optics, bird books with the intent of giving them to young birders. And so my wife and I have donated to that periodically when we upgrade and have an extra set of binoculars or bird books, we will donate to that. So that's an avenue that the public can do as well. If you want to help birder get started and you're not using your binoculars, they're in the closet, you're not getting out much anymore, donate them to the Arkansas Valley Audubon and they'll put them to good use, give them to some needy kids.
You mentioned a large field of view. What about magnification?
Yeah, I think 8 power is plenty good. Some, they generally go from probably 8 to 10. Some go as high as 14. You don't want to get that much magnification because the shake will be too hard to focus on things. But 8 to 10 power, good magnifications, and then a field of view of at least 30 millimeter up to 40 is very good as well. So.
And what about bird books? Do you have some besides your own that you could recommend?
There is a real, you know, technology. Let's start with that maybe. The technology that you can put on your smartphone now has replaced a lot of the books, okay? I grew up with books. That's what we looked at. You want to look up a plant? You looked up the book. You got the book. And birds, it was the same way, but our world is rapidly changing now where we have apps on our smartphone like the Sibley Bird Guide, like the National Audubon Bird Guide. And if you see a bird, you can quickly draw up and an image of that bird. We also have Merlin. Merlin is a phenomenal voice recognition software.
Is that from Cornell?
I believe it is.
Yeah.
And so I was just down here near the Malm Trail, and I heard something, and I put my Merlin app to use, and it's a very good tool for learning bird calls. But back to your original question, so there's technology, and if you can get that, it's a really good tool, but there's nothing like a book, too, where you can kind of thumb through, and that's an old-fashioned way of doing it, but it still works. National Geographic has a series of books. Peterson Field Guides have been good. The Sibley Guide is outstanding. Sibley's been into our valley, and he's birded it, and I haven't met him. My wife met him years ago. But anyway, he's got a very excellent bird guide for the United States.
All right, very good. What for people who are starting out and they want to get into birding, is there a particular etiquette that they should follow when they are birding?
Yeah. You know, the first thing you can do, a young person and their parent, you know, or a team of people, is to watch for local bird walks. Friends of the San Luis Valley Refuges sponsor bird walks. I've done a number of them in the past. And usually they're well publicized on KRZA and other avenues. And so you watch for them. And usually it's a parent that's going to bring a child along to teach them. And again, I think that's a good way to get started. Back to your question. What was it again?
Yeah, so what's the proper etiquette?
Okay,
I'll give you an example. I was with you out on the Malm Trail one time, mm-hmm. and we found a flicker feather mm-hmm. on the ground.
Right.
And instead of picking it up and keeping it as a souvenir, you said, just leave it right there.
Yeah. For both photographers and birders, there are rules of etiquette. And they're very similar. Both of them emphasize the welfare of the bird first. And so photographers, birders have very much the same motivations. We want to get good looks. We want to get images. We want to get close. But when is it too close? When is it too close where the bird gets nervous and flies and starts modifying its behavior? Where does it start squawking at you because you're in its habitat near its nest? So you always have to, that's the primary rule, is consider the welfare of the bird itself. Try not to disturb it too much, encroach upon it. The other thing is more of the interpersonal relationships, a respect for private property, for closed wildlife areas. And I've seen violations of all of these. It's kind of, you know, even among, you know, us birders, you know, it can happen. People get enthusiastic about a rare bird and boy, at all costs, I got to see that thing, you know? So limits get pushed and birds can get disturbed. So it's important to follow etiquette. The ethics of birding are put out by the American Birding Association. Read them. The photographers have their set of ethics and conduct. And they're very similar. But I read them every year and try to go over them and try to be a better birder. In the case you brought up, the flicker feather, it's an item that we're not allowed to have. It's an item that's protected under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. Whereas a mallard feather, a pheasant feather, those of game and huntable species, you can stick the pheasant feather in your hand if you want.
You know, you mentioned photography just now, and I've seen your photos, and they're magnificent. Do you have any recommendations for cameras for beginning birders to use? Something other than just their cell phone?
Yes, I do. As you know, I've got two daughters. Camille's 20, Alyssa's 23. And on this trip Alyssa really recently did a studies abroad program in Tanzania. And I thought, you know, what kind of camera could she take that would be the nicest compromise, give her magnification to photograph elephants and leopards and things like that, but at the same time not employ the cumbersome lens that I carry, the two camera bodies and multiple lens that you have to put in. So I did some research on that, and there are some very, very good cameras made by Canon, Sony, other companies as well. And they have telephoto capability. They can zoom out to tremendous distances and bring the image in, or they can do something very close. They can retract and photograph a bird 15 feet away. So I ended up buying my daughter a Canon SX70, which was a nice, small, compact unit that you could throw in your day pack and take it out in a moment's notice and photograph a bird or whatever you wanted to do. What's the cost of that? They were about $750. It's hard to look at cell phone images because the bird is so small. The point and shoots just don't give you enough magnification. And, you know, I run a newsletter for birders in the valley, and oftentimes I get cell phone images that are blurry, incomplete, and are a real challenge. They'll ask me, what is this bird? And it's, you know, sometimes I honestly have to answer, I don't know, you know. I enjoy the challenge, though. But anyway, that camera would be a nice compromise between big lenses and, you know, meeting the need that you had out there to do wildlife photography and birds. So
do you have a favorite place in the valley that you go repeatedly for watching birds?
I do. Lately it's become real common for me to go to Smith Reservoir.
He's a fisherman also, I should point out.
Yeah. And I do write fishing reports for some of those lakes as well. But Smith, I used to say this about San Luis Lake, which is north up by Mosca. I would say on any one birding day, I know there to be a rare species out on that lake. But I'm not sure I will ever find it on this day, but it's out there. Okay, so it had that kind of intrigue. And, you know, San Luis Lake is a mile across, and even with a scope, there are birds way, way out there that are hard to see. So really now my go-to place is Smith Reservoir, and I would transfer that motto that on any given day, Smith is going to have a rare or unique bird on it. I may not find it, but I'm going to go try. And I read the eBird reports, and invariably, I'll go there one day, and the next day somebody will find a Cassin sparrow, or yellow-throated vireo this spring. And I'm like, I was just there. How did they see it? You know, and that's kind of the challenge of birding. You're not going to see them all, and it varies from hour to hour sometimes. So.
Yeah, that old saying among fishermen, you should have been there yesterday.
Absolutely, it applies.
or the next day or something like that. Sort.
Absolutely applies.
do you have a, you've been to many locations outside the valley and even outside the United States. Mm-hmm. Do you have a favorite trip in terms of birding that you'd like to share with our listeners?
You know, there's the wish list, definitely a wish list. Peru is on the short list because of the archaeology. I'm fascinated. I find that birders and archaeologists are somewhat of the same ilk. I mean, there's a lot of similarities, and I've known many over the years that if you like birds, you probably like archaeology. So to me, Peru has got the dual fascination of the Incas, Machu Picchu, and then tremendous diversity of birds in the jungles on the east slope of the mountain ranges, not to mention that you're going to be able to see glaciers in the high Andes, and that's a soil geology kind of fascination. So I'd say Peru is on the short list. Another trip to Costa Rica would be great. Been to Ecuador, The Yucatan is all fascinating, I think. So there's plenty of places. Australia maybe in the future, don't know for sure. So,
but of places that you have been,
yes,
is there one trip that stands out in your memory?
You know, I think Costa Rica probably is the place where there was, like, what, 1,800 species of birds in a country that's, like, tiny. And in all of North America, we have 850-900 different species of birds. So, you know, nearly twice as many birds packed into a country the size of maybe West Virginia. And the diversity is just amazing. I've been there once, and I would go back at the drop of a hat anytime. There's just so much to see.
I have some friends who were in Costa Rica within the last year or two. And one of the things that they talk most fondly about is seeing a quetzal. Did you get to see one when you were in Costa Rica?
We did. We went into Monte Verde, which is the place to find them. And our timing wasn't the best. We were there during a rainy season. But you have to do it when you can do it. So we were out there with our guide, and the guide said, this is generally where the bird is. And we're all looking around, and it's kind of foggy and drizzle. It's a cloud forest that's going to have fog and mist. So we're all looking around for it, and my wife, Lisa, who's got eagle eyes, says, there it is. And it was, like, straight up above our heads, perched on a branch. And so we all got to see it, even with rain and mist falling in our eyes. And my photos never came out very good because of the conditions. It was harsh conditions, but that was an amazing bird to see.
But your mental photograph is still sharp.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
Well, John, it's been great talking with you. Do you have any last words of advice for birders or just anything else that you'd like to share?
You know, I think my closing message would be to get outdoors, to put aside the device, take that walk for an hour, breathe it in, smell the aromas of summer, and take in the beautiful green colors that we have across the landscape now. Make sure that you get outdoors and kind of refresh your spirit, because it's so easy to get caught up in the digital world. And I take grief for it because I'm not as prompt on my email or text messages as I talked with Chris earlier. But that's the price I pay. You know, I enjoy getting outdoors, and I don't always have my smartphone with me. Get outdoors and breathe it in. Either find local bird trips, find local trips to archaeological sites. The Valley has a lot to offer. It really does. And so take the time, and then take youth out there. Try to get the kids out there. And that's no easy task. I mean, as a parent, I went through, you know, challenges trying to get the kids out in the field and having them appreciate the great outdoors that we've got. I mean, we live 4 miles from the Monte Vista Refuge. You got to get out and see it.
Well, we've been speaking with John Rowinski, birder extraordinaire from the San Luis Valley, author of the book Birding Hotspots of South Central Colorado, photographer, again, as we said at the beginning, a Renaissance man between music, birding, writing, you name it. John's done it. So thanks a lot, John. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Marty. Nice to be here.
We'll be right back with our string of outdoor conditions and news, as well as some upcoming events after this brief sponsor break.
Our friends at Ulta Convenience are offering customers a way to earn points and save, like save 3 cents per gallon of gas purchased. You can take advantage of special offers, like purchase 6 fountain drinks and receive 1 free, or purchase 9 Ulta premium burritos and get 1 free. Stop in at any participating Conoco-branded Ulta Convenience kickback store to pick up your free kickback card and start earning points today. Points can be spent just like cash at Ulta, so the more points you earn, the more perks you can enjoy. Redeem points at the pump or in store for snacks and merchandise.
Welcome back. We have some conditions for you. Last month was quite a weather month. Here's the June weather report gathered from the National Weather Service. The preliminary average temperature in Alamosa for the month of June was 64.3 degrees Fahrenheit. This is 3.7 degrees above normal and makes it the second warmest June on record in Alamosa, just behind the 64.5 degree average temperature recorded in 2012. You may remember 2012 was a pretty significant drought year for us. The average June maximum temperature in Alamosa was 82.3 degrees, which is 2.1 degrees above normal. And Alamosa recorded 2 inches of precipitation through the month of June. This is 1.57 inches above normal and makes it the second wettest June on record, just behind the 2.58 inches of precipitation recorded in 1969. July is leaning toward a below-average precipitation month with above-average temperatures. And nationwide, here's a quick bit of weather news. Death Valley National Park in California recorded a high of 128 degrees Fahrenheit on Saturday. Hurricane Beryl, which broke the record for the earliest Category 5 hurricane on record, made landfall in Texas as a Category 1 storm yesterday and is expected to spin out over the interior U.S. as a tropical depression. Now we have some news. Other than just weather news, in spring of 2024, the Colorado Department of Transportation, or CDOT, kicked off an update to its statewide active transportation plan. Now it's asking residents to take the active transportation survey. The URL is too long to give it to you in the podcast, but you can find a link to the survey in the outdoor field report on alamosacitizen.com. The survey takes about 5 to 10 minutes to complete and asks about your walking and biking habits. It also comes on the heels of our recent series on bicycling in the San Luis Valley. You can read the full results of that survey on alamosacitizen.com as well. In other news, this year's first case of West Nile virus was confirmed in Arapahoe County in late June. Due to the high amounts of rain we've received so far this summer, the mosquitoes are particularly hungry and active. Colorado had the highest recorded number of West Nile virus cases in the United States in 2023. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention has also issued an advisory for dengue fever as it is seeing a global uptick in cases. The San Luis Valley is full of standing water and plenty of places for mosquitoes to lay eggs. It's important to keep yourself protected when outside. Long sleeve clothing, long pants, staying in well-ventilated areas, and using repellents like DEET and Picaridin can help keep mosquitoes away. The Alamosa Riverfront Project is becoming fully realized and aims to utilize Alamosa's easy access to the Rio Grande to connect the community back to the river. The Rio Grande Headwaters Restoration Project is spearheading this project that could change how residents interact with the low and slow section of the Rio Grande that cuts right through town. Recreation and restoration will go hand in hand by creating a space near Cole Park that adds a seamless transition to the water to float, fish, play in the sand, or just to be closer to the Rio Grande. As John Rowinski, our guest, would tell you, the Rio Grande Corridor is a great place to go birdwatching. We have more on this story on alamosacitizen.com and will provide dates and details for the next community meetings in the coming weeks. A volunteer organization has submitted 188,000 signatures to the Colorado Secretary of State for a petition that would ban hunting of Colorado's big cats. Initiative 91, circulated by a group called Cats Aren't Trophies, would make illegal any trapping, hunting, or killing of bobcats, lynx, and mountain lions. The group argues that big cat hunting in Colorado isn't about hunting, but is instead a trophy sport. Opponents of the measure have called the petition fringe and have voiced their concern for what it would do to wildlife management. Colorado Parks and Wildlife already heavily manages big cat populations and licensed hunts. If the petition garners the minimum 124,000 registered voter signatures after the Secretary of State's audit, it will appear on the November ballot. Colorado Parks and Wildlife is seeking public input on its 2024 statewide comprehensive outdoor recreation plan. The feedback opportunities will help shape how outdoor recreation looks in Colorado's future. According to a new CPW public survey, 72% of Coloradans engage in weekly outdoor recreation, with 81% citing it as vital for their well-being and 90% feeling more positive after participating. I know that's certainly true for me, and I believe it is for Owen as well. And you just heard John encouraging you to get outside, saying how valuable that is. Most activities occur at local parks and trails, with walking, hiking, and picnicking being the most popular. Motivations include enjoyment, mental health benefits, and spending time with loved ones, while barriers include lack of time and crowded areas. The draft statewide comprehensive outdoor recreation plan presents a path forward that aligns conservation efforts with public interests and research management needs, ensuring a balanced approach to maintaining Colorado's natural areas amidst growing population and pressures on public lands, said CPW Director Jeff Davis. The public has until August 6 to review the draft 2024 comprehensive plan and provide feedback to Colorado Parks and Wildlife. For more information and to provide feedback, visit engagecpw.org. Our latest outdoor field correspondent report is up on the Alamosa Citizen YouTube channel. The report is from Hannah Eubanks and features her recent night visit to the Great Sand Dunes National Park and Preserve. Pretty cool. You better check it out. And we welcome all of our listeners to send us their very own outdoor field report. Next time you're out for a hike or a walk, a bike ride, a river rafting trip, climbing up a cliff wall, or sitting by a fire, send us a little audio, video, or even a photograph or two, and we'll feature your report in a future episode. Send field reports to info@alamosacitizen.com with your name for credit. You can view all of our previous field reports on the Alamosa Citizen YouTube channel. We've had quite a cast of correspondents who we've enjoyed hearing from, and we hope you enjoy their adventures too. Next up, we have a look at some upcoming outdoor events. SLV Goes Nature RX and Runs are going strong into July every Thursday at 6 a.m. at the Alamosa Disc Golf Course. On Tuesday, July 16th, there will be a community group bicycle ride at 6 p.m. The meeting point is on the north side of the river near the boat takeout. This Saturday, July 13th, at the Monte Vista National Wildlife Refuge from 8 a.m. to about noon is a Saturday bird walk hosted by the Friends of the San Luis Valley National Wildlife Refuges. The highlight of the walk will be water birds. These bird walks are open to the public and free. The meeting spot will be at the Monte Vista Refuge Visitor Center parking lot. Dress for the weather and wear suitable footwear. Hats are helpful, as are binoculars, a camera, water, snacks, sun, and insect protection. The city of Alamosa is having a youth birding hike and birdhouse workshop on Saturday, July 20th, 2 p.m. at the Alamosa Library and Cole Park. The event is open to youth aged 6 to 12. It's free, and all of the birdhouse materials are provided. Parents and guardians must stay on site during the event. Wear appropriate gear for a hike. Bring water and sun protection. For more information, call the Alamosa Family Rec Center at 719-589-2105. Or you can visit www.alamosarec.com. And that ends this episode of the Outdoor Citizen Podcast. Join us later in July for our next episode. If you have an interesting outdoor story or adventure you'd like to share, or if there are topics or ideas you'd like to hear on a future episode, reach out to us at info@alamosacitizen.com. The Outdoor Citizen is supported by SLV Go and is produced by Owen Woods. As always, we want to thank Don Richmond for his song Sea Turtle and Daniel Boyce for the sounds of the valley's birds. And until next time, this is Marty Jones saying get outside, go do some bird watching, and we'll see you later this month.
As easy as it would be to stay in and binge your favorite show, you don't want to miss out on all the events happening in the San Luis Valley this summer. The Valley Calendar helps you stay in the know when it comes to community social runs, holiday events, live music, and more. It's the most comprehensive and useful listing in the Valley. If you have an event coming up, be sure to submit it to the Valley Calendar on alamosacitizen.com. Let's have some fun this summer.